This is the Heartland Collegiate Compendium. The legal and regulatory environment of business. Lecture 12, delivered on the 14th of July of 2008. The title of this lecture is Discrimination in Employment.
Tonight, discrimination in employment. The history of the United States, as you were probably told in your earlier years, was generally quite favorable, with just some notes about the problems of slavery and a few other issues, maybe the problems we had killing Native Americans and reneging on treaties. As you come into college, you are exposed to more and more of the seamy, dirty side of American history. Oftentimes, that story is the story of employment. Workers who are discriminated against, workers who are abused in their employment, and also workers successfully building an incredible nation. In the 1800s, of course, we had the Civil War, which was a watershed in many ways. It established once and for all the supremacy of the federal government. And as such, it thereby gave the federal government the ability to project public policy in a national way through legislation, through law enforcement, and through the general tone of the government as it conducted its affairs with the several states and the citizens of those states. Coming out of the Civil War, it was, of course, obvious to anyone of any enlightenment at all that our country had discriminated against black people, against Negroes, as they were called, and also against other groups as well. We have a history of discrimination. Black people after the Civil War certainly could not get employment in the South any much better than they could before the Civil War. However, there were other groups that were also discriminated against. We have a number of stories of the history of our country. You can see for example, my own name was changed because there was concern with my grandfather that we would be identified as German Jews, and they were reviled, they were hated in the 1800s in this country. Thus, my name does not have its original K, it has a C as a way of hiding our Germanic Jewish past. But we also, this discrimination was against Chinese, against Irish, against just about anyone. Some of these groups were successfully able to create enclaves of business activity for themselves and were able to overcome quite a bit of the discrimination. Other groups could not, for one reason or another. Women have suffered greatly as far as discrimination in employment goes. We press them into service because we need their services in the work environment, sometimes in extraordinary ways, as in World War II when the men were off fighting. But generally speaking, women have suffered enormously. The stories of sexual harassment, of rape, of discrimination in pay, discrimination in promotions are just too numerous to even begin to catalog. Many of them were never told. There's stories of women have held secretly after the horrors that happened to them in the work environment. And other groups, again, have suffered also. Even to this day, we find that, for example, Hispanics suffer higher death rates on the job than do whites, even when you adjust for the risk of the work. Hispanics tend to take on the dirty, filthy jobs that the white Americans are too good to take on generally. But even when you take that out of the picture, Hispanics die at a higher rate on the job than do whites. There have been civil rights acts passed addressing social concerns that had employment impact. Perhaps the first would be the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which forbade discrimination in contracts. Now, because employment is a contractual relationship, that would mean that you could interpret the CRA, the Civil Rights Act of 1866, as perhaps the first non-discrimination legislation with respect to employment as regards black people. The triumphs began, and the great trials of the 20th century began but in 1941, the Brotherhood of Sleep Car Porters staged a march. These are black men, mostly, almost entirely. Porters were in that day. And matter of fact, in the movies of that era, you will see that always a porter was a black man with a silly hat on, standing there taking care of the baggage for people getting on trains and stuff like that. They staged a march on Washington, a job action, as it were, and simply let it be known that there was discrimination, they didn't want it, they were sick of it, and they had enough force to become a presence that could march on Washington. Quite an impressive event. Let me get down into the 1950s. Major, major Supreme Court decision. Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. Black children were educated in schools separate from the white children. There was generally a sense, and this was pervasive, even in my time, that blacks and whites should not mix. I grew up, enough of my life, I remember white people only water fountains, black people water fountains. I grew up in the era when there were places where you would see signs, colored people sit at the back of the bus. I saw this. In 1954, the separate but equal education theory, doctrine, dogma, whatever you want to call it, was shot down by the Supreme Court. It's not enough to give these little Negro children a quality education. You have to put them in the schools with the white kids. As a result of that, you got the decades-long clarion call of the right-wingers and the conservatives. Well, this is creating busing. We have to truck these black kids to the white schools. Why can't we have neighborhood schools? Neighborhood schools is a dog whistle. It is a term that is used to hide the fact that we want our lily white children to be in lily white schools because we live away from the blacks. We keep them out of our schools. We keep them out of our neighborhoods. So why should we have to truck kids around so that they mix races? Now, there is a legitimacy to this argument in the sense that busing plans to integrate schools in urban areas created nightmares for kids going clear across town, no sense of connection to their communities and all of that. It was a remedy that was not all that great. And it was also a dog whistle for racist sentiments anyway. Not too long ago, busing was pretty much ended in this country. But Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, found the concept of separate but equal to be unacceptable. It is against public policy to simply say, well, we take care of the Negroes. We take care of these other people of other colors. But we just want to keep them separate from our white people. That's not acceptable public policy. It was ugly. It was ugly. A little girl being taken up the steps to the school that she was never supposed to be in, a little black girl actually being escorted with military
National Guard people. Quite a thing. One of those times when the United States has to be jerked by the neck into understanding that it can't do things like what it was doing. But let me go on here. There was a lot of racial tension in the 50s, a lot of it. There was, in my part of the world, there was concern that these Negroes were going to take over, they were going to kill people. There was always underneath that there were these whispers about how these, and I won't use the filthy term of the time, but these black men were going to start having sex with our white women and all that kind of disgusting stuff. The term mongrelization was thrown around, mixing of races to create half white, half black kids. You had some very strong leaders beginning to show up, and the 50s, late 50s and 60s, and you certainly saw the entertainment world was exposing more and more people to blacks, Hispanics, and different worlds we were seeing. And it was quite a turbulent time, just coming into the early 60s. But then you had leaders, social leaders, preachers. Malcolm X, a leader, a very amazing, great, strong man. Martin Luther King, of course, and all of those kinds. And as I said in an earlier lecture, Jack Kennedy was elected president in 1960. And Kennedy brought an enlightened Eastern liberal mentality with him. It was time for us to grow up, to be cool, to be a sophisticated, urbane society. When Jackie Kennedy, his wife, took live cameras into the White House, brought the news media, and she wanted everyone to see, America can see the White House. That was not an effort to bring the White House down to the level of the common people. That was not what that was all about. It was not this reality TV of our era. It was exactly the flip side of it. It was like bringing America up to being cool, being with it, being modern. That was the whole idea back then. It was exactly the flip side. A lot of that live TV, like reality TV we have today, of what it is now. Hey, it's time to stop being a bunch of a country of hillbilly hicks. It's time to get with it. And part of getting with it is getting over your racism. Getting over your sense that white people are the only good people. Getting over your sense that being some redneck idiot, uneducated, is what America is all about. Jack Kennedy, among the things that he wanted to do, was to get a Civil Rights Act passed. A real Civil Rights Act that would broadly express a public policy prohibiting discrimination in employment, prohibiting turning our society away from a society of divided communities and into a society recognizing the fulfillment of the idea of the American melting pot in all of its glory. Well, Jack was shot down. He was gunned down in Dallas, and that was, to some extent, the end of a lot of his dreams. But interestingly enough, I've said in posts that articles I've written that Jack Kennedy was actually in some ways a minor footnote in history. He really was. He was president for 3 years about. But there was something about his way of thinking that lived on past him. In his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, a good old boy, blue dog, Southern Democrat, born and raised racist as hell in a state that is racist as hell, in a country that was racist as hell, Lyndon Johnson did the right thing in
pushing his fellow Blue Dogs to do what was just unimaginable. And so in 1964, the Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and there have been a number of Civil Rights Acts, by the way, in our country's history, but this is the Civil Rights Act. And it was passed by Congress with Lyndon Johnson twisting a whole lot of arms of his Blue Dog Southern good old boy friends to get this thing through. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, sex, religion, or national origin. You can't discriminate. Now, the Civil Rights Act applies to any employer with more than 15 employees, any union with more than 15 members, or any city hall, state, or local government. It applies to most of the federal government, too. Unfortunately, one of the exempt organizations is the Congress. The Congress has a very bad habit of making itself exempt from the laws it expects everyone else to abide by. Congressmen would piss all over themselves if they were subject to the laws that they are putting on us every day, and especially in this era of snooping that our government has become obsessed with. Title VII was major. Interestingly enough, let me bring up, and I gotta be careful, there's a terminology, and I think I mentioned this, but let me mention it again. When we're talking about race, sex, creed, and things like that, national origin, color I'll put down, national origin, and by the way, it's not gender, it's sex. Gender is a grammatical term. We're talking about the sex of the person, male or female. Interestingly, one thing that had not come on the scene, one discrimination that was still, it was horrific in the time, horrific, but it had not come about to the extent where it was included in the Civil Rights Act, was sexual orientation. The legacy of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is horrific. In the 1950s, homosexuals were put in institutions. They were castrated. They were electrocuted. They were had lobotomies taken to them. They had medical, surgical, and drug experiments done on them. They were the subject of spying by our FBI, even though the leader, the head of the FBI, a thug named J. Edgar Hoover, was himself a homosexual who paraded his boy toy around at restaurants at the time. Even though some of the other fiery anti-gays, just like now, some of the other fiery anti-gays of the time were as gay as blades themselves, it was still not on the national radar sufficiently for sexual orientation to be included in the Civil Rights Act. And so since then, it has just been a pitched battle, running battle for gays and lesbians, trans, queer, and others who are of alternate sexual orientations. And that battle will continue for some more years. It'll eventually get resolved. The unfortunate thing is that discrimination is like a horrible weed. You can kill it, you can burn it, you can make laws against it, but it will just keep coming back over and over again. Passing a law does not change people's hearts unless they really believe in their country's ways. We are, to this day, we still have race discrimination in this country. We have great examples of discrimination all the time. We have discrimination on the basis of sex constantly. There are sexual harassment complaints. Glass ceilings still exist. Women are paid less than men for comparable work. We still have discrimination on the basis of creed. Unfortunately, sometimes religion gets to be an ugly, difficult issue to deal with, because there are, when does a religion cross the line and become so contrary to public policy that we can't have these people behave the way they are, and we can't allow them to be employed unless they conform a little bit to our national character. Also, national origin has become a big issue again since 9/11, especially in the days after and weeks after 9/11. In the streets of big cities and even in smaller communities, Arab young men were rounded up by the thousands. Some of them ended up in Gitmo. Some of them ended up being sent to other countries. The vast majority of these young men had nothing to do with terrorism whatsoever. A great example of this was a young man who was collected up in New York City. When he was finally brought before a judge, his lawyers said he's been tortured. He's been beaten. He's been beaten bloody. Now, the young man was standing there in shackles with a big orange jumpsuit on. The judge said he looks fine to me and sent him off. Later, when he was finally put into a humane treatment, given some humane treatment, his jumpsuit was off and the doctor said, this man's been beaten shitless. That judge is Michael Mukasey. He is now our Attorney General of the United States of America. Unqualified to do medical examinations, he nevertheless saw no problem with just simply dismissing a young Arab man's claims that he was being beaten, that he had been beaten. And that story has been repeated over and over again. It's part of our national character that we don't want to face the ugly side of ourselves sometimes. Let me give you a couple of issues here to deal with. Now, when I write these terms here, I'm going to race, sex, creed, color, national origin. You're going to hear me use a term called protected class. Now, for some reason, I'll slip into a language using the term suspect class. But I'll try to keep from saying that. Protected class is anyone who would be subject to discrimination on the basis of one of these right here. So you as a female, ma'am, would be at least, and this is where I have to be careful. I want to say you're a suspect class, but I'll probably just stick to protected class. It's not necessarily the case that everything that happens to you that's bad in employment is discrimination on the basis of sex. You might very well just be a sucky worker. You might be a terrible worker, lazy, incompetent, I'm going overboard there. But you, sir, are not a protected class. You are not a suspect class. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, I am gay. No, you're looking, no, I'm not. But even if you were, you would not be protected or suspect. Nothing, because that's not in the act. Okay?
Isn't sex and race in there?
Sex is in there, race is in there, but if you were black, you would be suspect. I would say you're protected. You're a protected class as a Negro, as an African American. Let me put it this way. You are protected as an African American. You are protected as a Negro. Now, interestingly, it gets a little bit complicated with respect to people who are of mixed race. Many are the people who, you might not believe that they are part African American because they look white. Or you might say, well, is Antonio Banderas in a protected class? The answer to that is maybe. Maybe. If there was a discrimination that was on the basis of his national origin or something like that, possibly. Now, a Jewish person, a Muslim, their religion constitutes a protected puts them into a protected class. However, a white United Methodist Church member, male, 40 years old, is certainly not in any protected class. His race is not suspect to discrimination. His national origin, his religion, his color, his sex, none of those are generally subject to discrimination. However, there have been claims of reverse discrimination, some of those successful, that are reasonable to understand in the context of the protected classes. They are not protected just absolutely under the Civil Rights Act, under Title VII, but relative to enforcement of the act and relative to the definition of protected classes, there might be a claim of reverse discrimination. Let me put up a couple of exemptions. Exempt. Religious organizations are generally exempt from Title VII. Prohibitions on employment discrimination, at least as far as religion goes. In other words, a Jewish charity does not have to hire Muslims. Religious organizations are generally exempt. As I said, Congress has exempted itself from pretty much everything that it passes. And what was I thinking? I'm going to break this off here very quickly. These are generally exempt. However, you would not be able to sue them under Title VII. You would not be able to sue under Title VII. Most states enforce anti-discrimination laws and the federal government does, through the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. In general, when you have a claim of discrimination, it must flow through the EEOC, where it can be resolved by mediation, possibly, or by just a finding in some cases. And only after it has been reviewed by the EEOC can you seek redress in court through various mechanisms, including the EEOC issuing a right to sue letter. Now, when you file a complaint with the EEOC, it must be filed within 180 days of the action that is subject to the complaint. This created a furor just recently when the Supreme Court dismissed a claim that was of egregious harassment, of egregious discrimination, simply because there had not been an initial filing in the proper period of time. And so the Supreme Court took the advantage of this technical flaw or this technical defect to deny justice to someone who clearly deserved justice. Congress has moved, but not particularly successfully, to get the Supreme Court to understand that the will of Congress was not to give employers and the courts latitude and excuses for letting discrimination happen. But again, you file with the EEOC, there are remedies within the EEOC, and only when there is an exhaustion of remedies, either successfully or otherwise, are the courts available to you in general. In general. I also, by the way, let me, before I forget about this, there have been some additions to the original Civil Rights Act of 1964. For example, in 1991, the Civil Rights Act anti-discrimination language was extended was extended to American citizens working abroad, so that employers couldn't discriminate just because they were offshore. And then there was an executive order 11246, that also extended the Civil Rights Act anti-discrimination language to encompass, what was I thinking? The Americans with Disabilities Act. It brought several other anti-discrimination pieces of legislation into the fold of the anti-discrimination public policy of the country. So we have a whole panoply of acts, not just the original 1964 Civil Rights Act, but we also have the Americans with Disabilities Act, so that you can't discriminate in employment on the basis of disabilities. We now have anti-discrimination legislation that protects people who are somewhat older from discrimination in employment, essentially trying to find all the different ways that employers can discriminate unjustly and making it unlawful for them to do so, and to create the administrative mechanisms so that those people can find remedy within the government at the state and federal level. Now, we will continue. It'll take me a little longer than an hour. We'll have a break here before we continue, but let me get this on the board first. I have to stop talking about discrimination and how unlawful it is. And I have to tell you that it is not unlawful to discriminate in employment, provided there is a bona fide occupational qualification that is involved in what is otherwise discriminatory hiring practices. The BFOQ is a defense against a claim of discrimination. If a job requires some attribute that creates the effect of discrimination, then that discrimination is not unlawful, the discrimination that results. So, for example, if I'm hiring a wet nurse, I can say no to you, even if you are a Jewish black man. I can say no. Females are only are allowed. You do know what a wet nurse is, right? Okay, I just want to. Last semester, I had half the class was staring. What's a wet nurse? Dear God. Okay, I need a. Okay. That goes to the heart of what the job is about, the fact that you can produce breast milk. On the other hand, I cannot, as an airline, say females only need apply for the positions of attendants, flight attendants. Well, if we want the customers to be happy with these pretty girls and to charm the customers, and females have just such superior qualities at getting people to do what they want them to do and all that. No. The primary job of the flight attendant is to ensure the safety and the orderliness and the things like that on the flight. That is not something that requires a female to do. So it's not a BFOQ. Go ahead. They have to have, there was a guy who applied for a job as a Hooters waitress. What was the result of that?
I think Hooters won.
Why did they win?
Because of the uniform, maybe? I don't remember.
It's questionable whether that would survive. It's questionable. Let me try this one on you. I own a restaurant. and I'm on a restaurant in the South, and I do not hire black people to do the waitering jobs. Now, they can do the dishwasher, but I just won't hire a black person because my customers just are not comfortable with black people waiting on them at the restaurant. I'm sorry, I just can't do that. Do I have a bona fide occupational qualification in specifying that white people only apply for the jobs? Why not? My customers, this is going to have a serious adverse impact. That's about it. The job itself requires the movement of food and the taking of orders. There is no reason to believe, no reason whatsoever to believe that that job can be done better by a white person than by a black person. Therefore, this idea, as you said, claiming discrimination because my customers are discriminators, is just not going to fly. On the other hand, suppose that there were a health spa for women. For women between the ages of 18 and 30, a place where they could go and sit in sauna baths and sit in steam rooms naked, and they looked for a person to provide towels, a towel attendant, and they said females only need apply. You, of course, might like to have that job. Yeah, 10-4. You'll even work overtime and provide your own towel rack, I suppose. But here, is it illegal for them, is it unlawful for them to specify women only need apply for this job? Now, the argument, of course, would be this is unlawful because taking towels to these people, these customers, certainly does not require some special quality that only a female has. However, there is a larger concern here. It's not just that the females are uncomfortable with the presence of a male while they're all sitting around naked and sweaty. It actually comes down to legitimate belief on the part of the customers that their safety is at least in some way compromised by the presence of males. Historically, traditionally, there is far too much concern for women to get over that, and therefore it would probably pass muster as a bona fide occupational qualification. Now, here is a term that is sometimes used, intrinsic quality. When I want to hire, I want a model for a photo shoot, and I specify that I want a female, young, attractive, slender, white, am I discriminating unlawfully? The answer is no, because there is latitude given, rather wide latitude, for what would be considered intrinsic qualities necessary in, especially in an artistic framework. If I have in mind a specific artistic concept, the government should not prevent me from expressing my artistic concept as I wish. It is intrinsic to the nature of the job that I would want a female, that I would want a female who was white, that I would want a female who is slender, all of those things. There is a hazy area here, but this would definitely, when I was saying that I wanted a model and I was stating very particular things about this model that would seem to be discriminatory against others in protected classes, the courts would give me wide latitude and the EEOC would give me wide latitude. It would be very unlikely that I could be sued. On the other hand, this whole subject gets quite complicated, and I don't know if I want to get into everything about it.
But what I'm going to do is, in the next part, I'll take a break here for just a little bit, and then I'm going to go through the specific claims and then the specific defenses, and then I'm going to finish with the difference between disparate treatment and disparate impact, which is the essence of the what I wanted to teach in discrimination in employment lecture anyway. So take a brief break, and then we'll get back to this and finish it up. To begin again, I should mention that seniority systems can protect an employer from claims of discrimination. Now, that can be a bad thing because, well, you've been here, sir, for 25 years. And although this young female here has all of the qualifications for this position, we're going to give it to you based upon your seniority. The problem there, and that you can do. The problem there is that historically, an employer might have discriminated in the past and gotten by with it. And therefore, you have a lot of males, white males, who are able to get higher positions because of seniority. And there is no claim that the females can make, or at least they are substantially challenged in making a claim of discrimination. Okay?
With the seniority thing, though, couldn't you also say that, say, a person with seniority gets fired for someone new, could they say they were more qualified for your position?
That is an argument, yeah. Definitely. So you see, it gets a little complicated. Not a little. It gets quite complicated there. So, for example, you might have a place where someone applies for a position as a professor, and that person is not hired, and someone younger is hired. And the argument then goes, well, can't this person sue? Well, they're theoretically, possibly if he's old enough, he might sue for on age discrimination basis. But the other, they might come back with, well, the other person was more qualified, yes, but did you have this as a, was this a bona fide occupational qualification? And then there are, I could say, you see, there's an evolving common law, although it's been clipped off by the turn to the right of the federal judiciary. But the state judiciary, state courts have been playing around somewhat with an interesting idea that if you've worked someplace, and there is not a formal seniority system, but if you've worked someplace long enough, you come to have property in your work in that place. Now, of course, conservatives would say this is balderdash. This is just simply ridiculous. And I'm of two minds on it. But there is a decent argument there. Now, interestingly, there's a big state university here in town that will hire people full-time and then get rid of them, just simply not renew their contracts after their fourth year. Because there seems to be a trigger that at the fifth year, the state recognizes something along the lines of property in the employment. So they get rid of them before the university could be subject to that possibility. So it creates a problem in the sense that the idea of the property is interesting, but it also creates the disaster for people who work in jobs that even if they didn't want some promise of permanent employment, it would have been nice if they could have kept their jobs after serving 5 years. But they get kicked out. As a matter of fact, there's an individual here worked at that big state university for exactly 5 years. Just was told we don't have any classes for you anymore to teach. That way they avoided ending up having to hire that person in a permanent basis because they didn't want to. That if he had worked there another semester, he would have been essentially had what we call, he would have been vested in the job in some common law sense. Anyway, disparate treatment.
Now, the plaintiff's prima facie case hinges on providing either direct evidence of discrimination or indirect evidence. Direct evidence would be very difficult to obtain. Direct evidence, like a letter, "I'm sorry, we're not going to hire you because you are a black person. I'm sorry, we're not going to hire you because you're a woman or you're a Jew." That kind of direct evidence is very difficult to come by. So disparate treatment must be shown by the plaintiff's prima facie case hinging upon indirect evidence. Now, indirect evidence starts with the plaintiff demonstrating that he or she is in a protected class and that the applicant was seeking a job that the employer was looking to fill, that the plaintiff was qualified for the job, then that the plaintiff was denied the job, and then that the position remained open and the employer continued to seek applications. Or, and by the way, this is where the book doesn't go, it just misses it, or that someone else, not in the protected class, was hired, who was no more qualified. Now, here I need to make the point about qualified. When you hire, you have to make absolutely sure that you are laying out what the minimum qualifications are for the job. And that word minimum is sort of like employers try to use that as a safe harbor, saying, well, we'd like this, but boy, if you have more than that, we'll consider you superior. So we would hire someone who has, minimum requirement, master's degree. Okay, you have someone in a protected class apply, someone in a non-protected class apply. The person in the non-protected class has a PhD, and the person in the non-protected class is hired. Here's where the rub comes. When you said qualification was a master's degree, minimum qualification, did that mean that someone who had a higher qualification, who was unprotected, would be automatically given the job? The answer is, it depends. You have got to be very careful when you lay out the qualifications for a job. First of all, that they are BFOQs. And second of all, that you are not shooting for the moon and just dreaming, grabbing for the dream candidate who just happens to have more than you need. Well, this person also ran in a triathlon 10 years ago, so we'll hire this person. It has nothing to do with the job. It is not a bona fide occupational qualification. Now, in the same regard, with respect to discrimination on the basis of disabilities, you can't just say, we are not going to hire someone in a wheelchair. First of all, that would probably, in many cases, violate the Americans with Disabilities Act. More importantly, though, you as an employer are going to be held to a standard that you are seeking qualifications for which a reasonable accommodation cannot be made for those who are alternately abled. Now, let me be specific about that. Oh, well, you're in a wheelchair, so you cannot do this job. The question is, could reasonable accommodation be made by the employer so that a person in a wheelchair could do the job? You can't just say, well, we're not going to hire you because you're blind. can a reasonable accommodation be made? And the test is, would it create an undue burden for the business to provide the accommodation? Now, discrimination, people would love to have everyone be perfectly abled and athletic and good-looking and young and pretty and all of that kind of stuff. That's not how the American society works. And sometimes you will find as an employer that it is people with disabilities or people who are not what you dreamed of having who might be your best employees. My favorite example in the world of this is the gentleman who had a telemarketing company and he decided to start hiring blind people. And now he has no employees, I believe, except for blind people on the telemarketing phones. He found out that blind people are far better than sighted people for telephone work, because blind people work in a world where they don't see the people to whom they are speaking. Sighted people are out of their league when they have no visual cues from the people with whom they are interacting. Blind people, that's their lives. He found out that hiring people that were undesirable, blind, turned out to be the best business employment move he had ever made in his life. Reasonable accommodation means that you are going to be able, you have to be able to provide for people who have disabilities to the extent that it does not, for lack of a better term, speaking informally, wreck your business accommodating them. Now that I've gotten that back off the board, let me go back to disparate treatment and disparate impact. Now, if the plaintiff has laid out through indirect evidence the 5-point test that I just gave you, belongs to the protected class, seeking employment, job was qualified for the job, denied the job, position remained open, and the employer kept looking for applicants, or the employer fulfilled the job with someone who was not more qualified, and all that. Now, the defendant will come back with this defense, that there was a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for denying employment to the person in the protected class. Now, that legitimate reason could be based upon a bona fide occupational qualification, the intrinsic nature of the job, something intrinsic about the job, something along that line. However, of course, the plaintiff is going to come back and say, this is just a pretext. This is just a pretext for hidden discrimination. You're just saying this was a bona fide occupational qualification. You're just saying this was an intrinsic qualification for the job. So the plaintiff will bring out the prima facie case, either through direct evidence or through indirect evidence, and if it's indirect evidence, through the 5-point step-by-step. The defendant will come back and say there was a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for the decision that was made. The plaintiff will then come back with, this was just a pretext, your claim here of some BFOQ or some intrinsic thing, something like that. That was just a pretext.
What was the original plaintiff's argument?
The original plaintiff, first of all, has to do one of two things. Direct evidence showing, well, we didn't hire you because you're a Negro. We didn't hire you because you're a woman. We didn't hire you because you're a Jew. That's not going to happen hardly ever. Although once in a while you can subpoena something that will show it. More likely the plaintiff will have to show discrimination through indirect evidence. And the indirect evidence would be that the plaintiff belonged to a protected class. That, Oh, no. Okay.
Let me draw this out for you. Maybe that'll help. Okay. Plaintiff. This is a person who has been denied employment. This is a person who's going to take something to the EEOC, to the courts. Okay, the plaintiff has one of two routes. Okay. Direct evidence. I'll draw a line down. This way? Yes. And let me put here, defendant is dog meat. Is a defendant is screwed, dead. There, if you've got direct evidence, the defendant, the employer who discriminated against you doesn't have a prayer, really. You know. Okay, indirect evidence. And here, no. Okay, now along this one, you'll have stages. Protected class, plaintiff protected class, yes, no. If it's no, case over. Defendant wins. If it's yes, then the next stage in the process would be plaintiff applied for a job that the employer was seeking to fill. Here, yes, no. If it's no, case over. Defendant wins. If it's yes, then you go to the next round. And in that one, it would just simply be the plaintiff was qualified. Plaintiff qualified. The answer would be if it's yes or no. If it's no, then the case is over. If it's yes, then the next question would be, was the plaintiff denied the job? If the answer is no, then the case would never have been brought. If the answer is yes, then we go to the last one. If the plaintiff was denied, and the answer is, if the plaintiff was denied, did the employer continue to actively seek an employee for the job? Or did the plaintiff, or I'm sorry, did the defendant actively seek someone for the job? Or, alternately, did the defendant hire someone who is not from a protected class? Now, there's a game that some employers will play where they will get someone who is clearly slam dunk qualified in a protected class, and they don't want to hire that person for discriminatory reasons. What I have actually in my own life seen is that the employer will simply pull the job and then just wait for 6 months and then open the job back up again until that person, hoping that person will go away. I've seen that. That one's a pretty common one with employers who do not want to hire someone, and they know that if they deny the person the job, the person will hit them right away with discrimination suit complaint. And so what the employer will do is just simply say, well, we've decided we're not going to hire for this job now. For a while. And they'll lie low for 6 months, and then they'll actually close the job, and then they'll open it back up later, hoping that that person will have found some other work or will have forgotten about it. Okay, this is the indirect evidence route here. Now, this is establishing the prima facie case. This is establishing prima facie case. Whatever you're doing here. In the direct evidence or the indirect evidence, the plaintiff is establishing prima facie case, first phase case. Now, this is first phase. Remember, the defendant will have his or her day in court. Keep that in mind. But this is the first phase of it. On the face of it, there's discrimination, either by direct evidence or by indirect evidence. On the face of it, there's discrimination. And then the defendant, after all of this, if you get either the yes on the direct evidence route or you get yeses all the way down on the indirect evidence route, then you go to the defendant's side, and the defendant will most likely, defendant will say, okay, BFOQ, most likely, something like BFOQ, or alternately might make some claims similar to that. But at the point where the plaintiff has established prima facie, either through direct evidence or indirect evidence, the defendant must answer. The defendant can't just say,
We can hire, we just hired someone. What are you doing? We just hired someone. The defendant can't do that at this point. That if, once the prima facie case is done, the plaintiff's side wins unless the defendant can come back with something that is decent in response. And most likely the defendant will come do something along the line of BFOQ. Well, it was a bona fide occupational qualification, and the plaintiff did not meet that BFOQ. Okay? That's what the defendant would have to do, something like that. The defendant can't just sit back and say, so what? The defendant has to answer at this point, because the plaintiff wins if the defendant doesn't come back with something that's pretty darned good. Now, at this point, once the defendant, if the defendant comes out with something, tries to establish a BFOQ, well, we couldn't hire this person who was black because our customers wouldn't want a black person waiting on them. And so it's a bona fide occupational qualification, or it's intrinsic to the nature of the job that we have to have white people wait on white customers. Well, then the plaintiff, that one would fall apart on its face anyway. The plaintiff is just going to come back with saying the BFOQ or whatever this was here, BFOQ is mere pretext for discrimination. You're just trying to find an excuse. You're just making this up as you go along. You're racist or you're sex discriminators or something like that. You're just trying to find an excuse at this point. But I will tell you this right now, that if the plaintiff can establish the prima facie case, again, I can't emphasize this enough, the burden of proof shifts to the defendant. It is now the defendant's job to convince the commission or a court that this wasn't discrimination. Now, let me get down to disparate impact. A plaintiff attempting to show disparate impact must first of all demonstrate a specific employment practice or a policy that is causing the alleged disparate impact on a protected class. Again, the plaintiff, in showing disparate impact, must show that the specific employment practice or policy must identify something. Here it is. It's like maybe a test for employment or a requirement in the job description that is having a specific and identifiable adverse impact upon a protected class. And it must be provable by statistical evidence or something along that line that there is this adverse impact going on. So there has to be an identified, you have to show what it is that's causing the alleged disparate impact on a protected class. And then you have to show by statistics that it is actually doing some bad thing to the affected class that is protected. Now, you do those two, and you have your prima facie case as plaintiff, that you show that there was a specific practice or policy, and that you show through statistics or something along that line, that it was actually causing adverse impact. You do that, you've got your, you as plaintiff have made your prima facie case. The defendant is going to come back. These are the two directions that the defendant could go. The defendant will come back with that the practice or policy arises from a legitimate business necessity. From a legitimate business necessity, that's one direction. Or, I just wish I could say this a little bit better. Or that it is job related, the practice or policy. So, for example, if I'm hiring a nuclear scientist and it just happens that I have to be careful, I don't want to offend anybody, but you have Native Americans just can't do this job. There are just no graduates there, who pass the requirements for it. Or something like that. It's just job related. We have this employment test and we just don't have people. It has to be this way. Now, on this other one, where it's a practice or policy arises from legitimate business necessity, here's an interesting case, and it's actually kind of a blend of those two defenses there. A nuclear facility that will not hire women of childbearing age for certain jobs. The argument being that this could lead to sterility. It could lead to miscarriages. It could cause mutagenic, teratogenic, or something along that line. Therefore, we just will not hire women for this specific group of jobs where there is the possibility of exposure to levels of radiation that are considered to be within OSHA guidelines, but we do know that women can be hurt by these. They can have sterility. They can get cancers from this far more often than men can. They can end up having miscarriages, all those kinds of things. So we just don't hire women for those jobs. That would be a good defense. Even though you are definitely, there's a practice or policy, right there it is. See how it's meeting the first point of the two-point prima facie? There's a practice or policy. And then showing, obviously, there are no women in these jobs, so clearly there is adverse impact occurring. However, defendant comes back and says, look what can happen if we hire women. We have scientific evidence, lots of it. Then there's good defense. Now, here's the final round. If the defendant comes back with something like this, then the plaintiff's last round would be in response. Okay. Was there a means of accomplishing this policy or in carrying out this practice that would have been less discriminatory? Okay. Now that might include something like this. Okay, defendant. Yes, you've offered a good reason why you're not hiring women for this group of jobs. So why did you not try to balance that out by hiring more women to do the jobs that would, right around that would not put them in peril? Or why did you not provide for an environment that was safe for both men and women to work around these nuclear facilities? Possibly. Was there some way you could have carried out the same policy, had the same practices, but done so in a way that would not have created this kind of discrimination, that would have not had this adverse impact? Okay? So you see the three rounds. The prima facie would have been those two. Plaintiff would have to show those two. Then the defendant would have come back. I'm sorry. The plaintiff would have had to show the... The defendant would have responded from prima facie by one of these defenses. It's job-related practice or policy, or the practice or policy arises from a legitimate business interest. And then the plaintiff would have come back with, yes, but couldn't you have carried this out, the same policy or practice, with something that would have not created this kind of discrimination? Let's try a practice or policy in one of my favorites, something like this. We require that... Oh, I gotta be careful. Huh. Now, that's an interesting... I never thought of that. Never mind, I don't want to do that one. There will be one on the test where I'll do a disparate impact. There'll be a couple. Now, let me show you something here. Remember I talked about statistical evidence showing disparate impact through statistical evidence. Now this kind of simplified, but it actually is pretty much the rule. It's called the four-fifths test. And when I say it, it can be really confusing. But when you see it, when you see an example of it, it's not confusing at all. Prima facie case is established if those in the protected class meet a test less than 80% as frequently as those in the highest class under the policy. Watch. When I show an example, it makes all the sense in the world. It's stupid when you try to explain it, no matter how many different ways I try to explain it. But let me do one like this, okay, here. Okay. Class, number of applicants, number who pass. And let's do a test. We'll just do some kind of a job test that everyone has to take. Okay, now let's do blacks, Hispanics, whites, and Asians. Now let's say that as far as applicants go, the number of black applicants is 50. And of those 50 applicants, let's say 20 pass the test. Now, Hispanics, let's say that 10 applied, and we'll say that 9 passed the test. Whites, 100 applied, and 95 passed the test. And Asians, 20 applied, and 14 passed the test. Okay? Here we go. What we have to do, first of all, is look at the pass rates. First, we'll do the pass rates. Okay? Now, the pass rate here would be 20 over 50, which is 40%. That's the blacks. 20 of 50, 40% pass rate. The Hispanics, 9 of 10 passed, so their pass rate is 90%. Whites who took the job, 95 of 100 passed, so their pass rate is 95%. And Asians who took the test, 14 of 20 passed, which would be 70%. Now, watch how I do this. I'm making a little more than you really need to, but I'm just doing it. And I'll check mark. In the next column, I'll check mark the highest pass rate group. As you can see, it's the whites. So I'll put a check mark there. And now I'm going to go to the next one. Now I'm going way overboard, but it just kind of helps. Okay. So the next one I'm going to write is 80% of highest. So I'm going to look for the check mark row, and I see it's whites. Now, 80% of 95% is what I have to find. Okay, 80% of 95% is 76%. So finally, I ask below 76%. And on a test, I will do one of these, but the numbers will be easy to calculate. Here I went a little frisky on. I didn't mean to. Okay, below 76%. How about the blacks? What was their pass rate? 40%. Is that below 46%? Yes. How about the Hispanics? How about the Asians? And then you go protected to see if they're a protected class. Anyone a protected class for which there is a yes would have established one of the rungs of the prima facie case. That's the four-fifths test. Four-fifths is 80%. You see how it works? It's actually, I made it look more complicated, I think, with this table. I just wanted to show you each part of it. Essentially, all you have to do is calculate the pass rates, find the highest one, and then see if any of the other pass rates fall below 80% of the highest one. And if any of them do, and that's a protected class, that protected class then has prima facie evidence of discrimination. That's how it works. That's the bottom line of it. And that's all I have for you this evening. I thank you.